Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. They say the truth is stranger than fiction, but on our program today we'll learn that each can be pretty strange indeed. One of the most famous horror novels of recent times was William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist. The film version of 1973 was a very scary movie of the same name. The story centers, of course, on the demonic possession of a young girl. While a lot of it was the figment of Blatty's imagination, it was triggered by a very real exorcism that had taken place right here in St. Louis in 1949. It involved a teenage boy and was pretty scary in its own right. That event was documented almost 45 years later in the book Possessed, The True Story of an Exorcism by historian, journalist, author Thomas B. Allen. It was re-released a few years later with updated information, including the diary of one of the priests involved in the St. Louis exorcism. It's getting some renewed buzz on this, the 40th anniversary of that 1973 film. I'm Don Marsh, and very happy to welcome Thomas Allen to our studio. Tom, great to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for the invitation.
This is the right time of year, I guess, to be talking about such things.
That's
Halloween time.
It always comes up that way. And, there has been a renewed interest in it. I developed my own theory, which is now somehow or another hooked into zombies and the vampires, that they are kind of a gateway to this, and they're all crazy and this thing's for real. And I think that the for real is amazing to a lot of people. I got that feeling yesterday when I was talking at the university.
Yeah, you had about 500 or 700 people there.
Yeah.
Were most of them young?
Well, to me, everybody's young.
I'm with you on that. Go ahead.
But, it was a cross-country. It wasn't all kids. It was as if there were some adults who had their own personal knowledge of when the movie came out. But I think the questions at the end, most of them were from students. And they were good questions.
The interest in this, I understand you feel sort of ebbs and flows. And
yes.
It's been going on for 50 years or pretty close to 50 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Well, I think it really just is a series of discoveries. And you know, if you go back to the movie coming out 40 years ago, kids looking at that today, when I say kids, I mean anybody around 30 on down, they see a kind of corny movie. Mm-hmm. I mean,
still scary.
Everything's been improved, the spookiness that you can get into a horror movie now because of computer-generated stuff. But then when they find out that this is not wholly imaginary, that there was such a thing as an exorcism and there was a kid who was exorcised, then I think they start wondering about, you know, the sort of the boundaries of reality here. Mm-hmm. These are not Walking Dead, or these aren't vampires. This is something real.
What got you into it?
I'm a writer, and I came across the fact that one of the priests involved with the exorcism, there was a little piece in the Washington Post. I lived near Washington, that said he had given an interview to the Omaha paper. And I got interested. I thought I might make a magazine article in Washington. I knew little about anything that was going on in St. Louis. And I tracked him down. He was hard to find. It was Father Walter Halloran. He had been what the Jesuits call a scholastic, sort of a seminarian, and at the time of the exorcism. And we got to talking on the phone, and I said, I'm a writer. I was quick to tell him I had also been a Jebby boy, that I had 6 years of Jesuit education. And then it dawned on me, I had called him on Halloween. It was absolutely not planned. So he and I had a good laugh over that, and that kind of cemented our relationship over the phone. And he said, well, you know, I've got a copy of the diary that was kept. Would you like to see it? And I said, yeah. He said, well, I'll mail it to you. And that was it. I mean, it was that simple. And what I get in the mail is 24 pages, single-spaced. It was literally a diary. I thought it was somebody who had taken some notes during it. But it turned out that the exorcist himself, who was Father Bowdern, who had been the pastor of St. Francis Xavier Church attached to the university, that he had turned to his pal, Father Bishop, who was on the faculty at St. Louis University, and said, I want this case recorded. I want everything put down in writing. You know, a real Jesuit, make a report on this case. He referred to it as a case. And so they started just every single night when this went on, they would record it. And even more valuable, or not more, well, as, just as valuable at least, is they had the whole background of everything that had occurred by the time this reached St. Louis, because there was a whole chapter beforehand, and they were able to get moving on that too. And that's that became the basis of the book.
Well, we want to talk specifically about what went on during those weeks, but I know that the church wanted this information kept private and out of the hands of people like you.
Well, people like me, but not exorcists. What I found out was that this document circulated. It was almost a manual for the exorcists who exist all over the country, all over the world for that matter. But for good reasons, they keep a pretty low profile. But when I was working on the book, I realized I had 24 pages, and it was obviously more because the 24th page ends with a sentence that isn't finished. So I was interviewing another priest who had no connection with St. Louis, who was in North Carolina, and he had been the technical advisor on the movie. And so I said, you know, I wound up with 24 pages, and he said, well, I've got the rest. And he pulls out a copy of the diary, and he had the 25th page. And that had the beauty of authenticating this. I mean, I was looking at another copy, and it was in the hands of an exorcist. And then I realized that although it had been kept secret by the church, as you said, somebody had the sense enough to make it available to the priests who are very quietly and almost secretly exorcists.
Right. But you're Jesuit educated, you've indicated.
Yeah.
You're brought up Catholic?
Yeah.
Are you a practicing Catholic today?
No.
Okay. I think that's important to know.
Oh, yeah. Well, I pointed out in the book.
Oh, I know. I've read your book, and I found it fascinating indeed. I'm going to start kind of at the end here and ask you, after having gone through all of this and read all this stuff, do you believe that this young child, you call him Robbie in the book, a fictitious name, that he was possessed by the devil?
No. I feel he was possessed by something that was inside himself. And I lean toward the same feeling that Father Halloran, he and I became really good friends, and he never was able to make up his mind. He's taking a look at it with the faith of a Catholic priest and a Jesuit, and I'm looking at it as a former Catholic who was created by you know you're always a Catholic, but you know. But I don't have the faith to say devils and diabolical possession. But then you look at Father Bowdern, who's, you know, day after day for weeks is saying exorcism prayers over this boy. And when Blatty writes to him and says, tell me about it, I have a copy of the letter. Father Bowdern writes back, says, I can't tell you anything about it. I pledge the secrecy, but I'll tell you one thing. This was the real thing. And that's the guy who was there every night. So he had an intense personal belief that he was engaged in exorcism of a demon.
The Catholic Church will not admit to possession, will not accede to the possibility that the devil, Satan, can possess someone.
Well, it's not dogma. They're very careful about how much dogma they put out, you know, what you have to believe. Mm-hmm. And it's not in that category, but there's plenty of literature on it and plenty of active pursuit of kids, or not just kids, but people who said, I'm possessed. And there's a lot of exorcisms that go on all over the country. But the modern exorcism, at least in America, involves mental health. I mean, they get psychiatrists into the picture. And I saw one category, one exorcist saying that he had 33, wonderful number, right? Mm-hmm. Looking at 33 cases, 9 of them, he thought of might be worth doing an exorcism, and I think it got down to 6. In other words, he eliminates the people who just, are wearing tinfoil hats.
Well, and looking over the diary, Father Bishop always refers to whatever was involved as Satan, saying
yeah,
Satan said, Satan
yeah.
did.
Yeah.
So Father Bishop also thought that
that
he was possessed by the devil.
Yeah. When you read about it, that's one of the telling things about the diary is that while he's thinking about the diabolical aspect of it and he's dealing with the devil, this is Father Bishop talking, he also is doing this absolute detailed recording of what was going on. When he says the word, H-E-L-L is spelled across the kid's chest in blood by some kind of scratches, he says it was done in such a way that you could view hell by looking down on it. In other words, he goes into these very detailed descriptions of these crazy things that are going on.
While the boy's hands were visible and he could not have done it himself with a long fingernail or something like
that.
We want to talk specifically about that, but you have one line here that I want you to explain for me. You say that Satan collects Catholics for subjects. Just Catholics?
Well, the Catholics, as it's kind of evolved out of Christianity and, when Protestantism comes into the picture, it remains the Catholics who possess the idea of possession, that I think the Eastern Orthodox also does. But the Protestant mainstream does not accept the idea, and particularly the Lutherans.
Well, there are biblical references to exorcisms performed by Jesus.
Jesus performs at least 3 exorcisms, the most famous one being he takes out the demons and puts them in a herd of pigs. Pigs go over a cliff. But the way they get around that, if you want to get around it, is that 2 things. Jesus responded to local conditions. So if that's what the local people thought, okay, that's number 1. And number 2, the sign of a Messiah was someone who cured diseases. And what he's doing is curing a disease. That's the modern interpretation of Jesus' exorcisms.
All right. Fascinating stuff. We have to take a break. I'm talking with Tom Allen, who's the author of the book Possessed, The True Story of an Exorcism. It was an exorcism that took place right here in St. Louis in 1949 and was the inspiration for William Peter Blatty's book, The Exorcist. Many folks still familiar with that movie, which was released 40 years ago today. Back with Tom Allen in just a moment. We're going to talk about what happened here, and we certainly want to get your input as well. What do you think about all of this? This was a St. Louis event, prompted a very, very famous novel and a very, very famous movie. Tom Allen, our guest. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back to our conversation with Tom Allen, the author of Possessed, The True Story of an Exorcism. The exorcism, of course, took place here in St. Louis in 1949. Tom, we'll have to go through this relatively quickly because it's a long story, but it really begins with this young boy you call Robbie in the book who was in the Washington, D.C. area at the time, ultimately came to St. Louis. But he was brought up Lutheran, and that the Lutherans wouldn't really have very much to do with all of this.
No, they went when the first things were happening, most in the house, flying objects, furniture moving around, the kid waking up screaming, and he ultimately little scratches on his body that seemed to spell out words. They went to their Lutheran minister. The minister happened to be really interested in parapsychology, which was kind of popular in 49. There was a guy named Dr. Ryan at Duke University who was in Life magazine and talked a lot about paranormal activity, the big thing being telekinesis, in which somebody can will the movement of an object. And so he felt that that's what he was dealing with, that he was dealing with some kid who had the power to move things around. And But then he has the kid spend a night at his house so that he could directly observe him. And the bed vibrates while the kid is on it, and a big chair is thrown over. And Schultz wrote, his name was Reverend Schultz, wrote all this down, so, and I've seen the correspondence, and he can't figure it out. So he tells them, you should go to a Catholic priest. The Catholics know about this kind of thing. And they go to a priest locally in Maryland, and he says, okay, I'll perform an exorcism. He takes the kid to Georgetown University Hospital, Catholic Jesuit institution, straps the kid down to a hospital bed and starts the prayers of exorcism. And the account of it that has come out is that the kid somehow gets a hand to a piece of the spring in the bed and either bends it or breaks it off and slashes the priest's arm from shoulder to wrist, 100 stitches. Well, that's the end of that exorcism. And the family, then the kid, the mother one morning sees Louis on the kid's chest and says, does that mean St. Louis?
Because they had relatives here.
Yes. Yeah. Comes on the kids, so they get on the evening train and get to St. Louis.
But, you know, I've heard over the years a little about this telekinesis. So Uri Geller, I believe his name was, used to move spoons around.
Right.
Okay, I'll buy the spoons. I'm not so sure about a chair being thrown around a room.
Yeah. But, you know, you had this methodical diary that he eventually emerges from this. He has no less than 48 witnesses. Okay. I mean, 48 is not a lot when you think of, you know, how big a population you're dealing with. But everybody, even people who were kind of hesitant to say anything definitive about this. I mean, there was a physicist who had worked on the atomic bomb, and he said he saw something strange. There were a couple of local doctors, medical doctors, who were skeptical, and yet they felt things were going on. And if you don't believe it, you start thinking about the power of suggestion. And I know Father Halloran, who was my chief contact on this and a good friend, he was skeptical right to the very end. He never could bring himself to absolutely believe. And yet he said, I saw a bottle of holy water fly around. I saw the bed move. I saw scratches appear on the kid. While I was looking at him, I saw the scratches go down his arm. When you deal with witness accounts that detailed and that seemingly authentic, I don't know, my head just fills up with a combination of doubt and mystery.
It seems like people are looking more for an explanation above and beyond the possibility that this sort of thing could possibly happen.
Yet
there are recorded, incidents of people who have been possessed supposedly over the millennia, really.
Yeah. And right now, there is quite a number of exorcisms starting to show up among fundamentalists in America, even though their tradition is Protestant rather than Catholic. But if you start getting interested in the end of the world, then it's an easy skip over to possession by the devil. And I think the devil has become more real in some of the fundamentalist areas. But I'm left with I don't know at the end. And it's not satisfactory, but that's where I am.
While we're on this part of the story, we have an email here from Kirsten who writes, my mother has Tourette's syndrome, has always believed that this child very likely had it as well. This comes up in the book, seizures and things of this kind. TS can cause individuals to swear, push their bodies into terrible and painful contortions and the like. There are comorbid conditions that can account for many things that appear to have had a malevolent nature. Possible the strong belief, absence of knowledge of TS and the supernatural caused by priests may account for the unintentional fabrication of details furthered by their own belief.
Right.
You're nodding throughout this.
I talked to a psychiatrist who brought up the Tourette syndrome. theory. And and she was the director of child psychiatry at the National Institutes of Mental Health and written a book on it named Dr. Rappaport. And the one thing that bothered her about this whole business was the swiftness of the onset. She said mental illnesses don't come on overnight, that they're always a gradual presentation. And that doesn't seem to have happened. And that was the one detail that mystified her. Once she gets past that detail, then she's into mental illness, four or five different versions of mental illness.
This process here in St. Louis went on for a long time.
Right.
And at various locales, if
right.
you will. Can you give us the Cliff Notes version of how this progressed, and then we'll
okay.
get to the telephones?
After being in a relative's home, the exorcism began in a person's home
here.
To give the family a relief from screams and so forth, they took the kid for one night to the Alexian Brothers Hospital, and he seemed to calm down in the hospital. They bring him back to the relatives, and they even decided they would go back to Maryland. They go back to Maryland. Nothing is improving. Come back to St. Louis, and at that point, they decide to start the whole to have the exorcism be in the rectory of Father Bowden of the St. Francis Xavier's Church, where they're converting the kid to Catholicism with the permission of the parents. And then he's wild again, and they put him in the hospital, and that's where it ends.
Was the conversion to Catholicism considered part of the exorcism,
yes.
that if he were a good Catholic, that it might be easier?
Father Bowden found in the instructions, there were 21 instructions for an exorcist, and one of them sort of indicates that if you're Catholic, you're armored somewhat by being a Catholic, and he decides that's part of the strategy he's going to use, and he converts the kid. And the kid converts, and the family permits it. And the mother converts later, and the father comes back to Catholicism. And all of that is part of the strategy on Father Bowden's part.
Another of the qualifications for possession is speaking, aside from the contortions and all the things we've talked about and all
yeah.
the things that we've mentioned, is the ability to speak in a foreign tongue, which this child was able to do from time to time.
Well, Father Halloran, who was there, when I asked him about that, he said that the kid was exposed to Latin constantly because the prayers are being delivered in Latin. And he was a smart little kid, and he memorized, for instance, the Ave Maria, you know, saying the prayer in Latin. There were also in the Alexian Hospital, the loudspeaker system would play masses. The mass in that time was given in Latin. So Father Halloran said it's no big deal if the kid could spout Latin, and that's the only language he heard. Now other witnesses claim to have heard other languages, which gets to be. One of them is the language of Christ and of his time, and then speaking in tongues. I mean, people are reading a lot of into moans and noises coming out of the kid. But Father Halloran, who was there, said he never heard it.
And yet it's one thing to have memorized some Latin that you're
yep.
hearing over a loudspeaker, and
yep.
another thing to actually say something in Latin that makes
yep.
sense.
Well, he does do that a couple of times, according to the diary.
Yeah.
And that one, okay, I don't know. The idea that he spoke only in Latin kind of lowers the level of he spoke in foreign languages because he was exposed to so much Latin.
Right.
And he didn't speak that much. And when he does speak in the diary, he's speaking in English. In fact, he's speaking like a guy
sailor.
In a bar.
A sailor.
yeah.
I think is the expression.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was the same case in Blatty's story, of course.
Yeah.
The little girl had quite a vocabulary
yeah.
for a 12-year-old. I want to give our telephone numbers now so people can get in on this conversation. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email if you prefer at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd like to send us a tweet, we'll take that as well at STL on air. And as we wait for folks to sign in, Tom Allen, a lot of stories over the years have been heard here in St. Louis about this exorcism, and much of it focuses on the Lexan Brothers Hospital,
right,
which has since been removed from the scene. But the room in which this child spent a lot of time was locked from the time,
right,
that he left. Why?
That was done at the time. There were two things done at the time. One was a statue about 3.5 feet tall of St. Michael is brought into his room. It was called a secure room. No doorknob on the inside. You can imagine what it was. It was for severe mental patients. And that the decision was made by the director of the hospital that the room be sealed. In 1978, when they're tearing down the building, one of the workers opens up the room, and it's all the furniture is moved out, and he sees a desk. In the drawer of the desk is a copy of the diary, and that's given to the administrator of the hospital. This is all back in around 78, and he doesn't know what to do with it. He sees that it has something to do with the exorcism. His daughter is going to school with somebody named Halloran. She sees the name Halloran in it. She said, "That's my friend's uncle. He's a Jesuit." And so to get the thing out of the hands of anybody, they give it to Father Halloran, and he puts it in a safety deposit box. And then I come along in 92, he decides to give me a copy of it.
Any speculation on your part as to why that document stayed in that locked room for all those years, and why who put it there and why?
Well, there's a letter that accompanies the diary, and the letter is from Father Bishop, who is the compiler of the diary,
right,
to the rector of the Alexian Brothers Hospital. And in that, he says, "I want to present you with this. You've been so helpful with us during this experience." So the only person who could have put it in was the rector of the hospital, deciding that he puts all the stuff in one place. They moved the statue. The statue of St. Michael's goes back to the Alexians and winds up in their headquarters in Illinois, and they have a little museum, and that's where it is.
When the building was being torn down, weren't there some strange things going on? Or are we looking at the potential for a lot of myth in connection with this?
Yeah, well, the myth has been growing daily. But here's the thing that I came up with. I was directed to speak to one of the Alexian brothers who had been on the premises, and he was talked with great reluctance. But he did talk, and he said that just before the entire wing, where the kid was definitely, is torn down, he, this brother, went into the room and found strange things written on the wall. And I said, "What were they, satanic?" Meaning, you know, the kind of thing you hear about people writing, "Satan is here" and that. And he said, "I don't remember," and he backed off any detail. I think he was innocent of satanic writings that, you know, somebody would do. But it became evident that somebody had actually entered that room and decided to spook it up somehow.
Well, there's plenty to spook up this story in a lot of people's minds. I'm going to take a call from Mark, who's calling from Brentwood, because he wants to get to the end of the story very quickly. But that won't disrupt what we're talking about. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Fascinating guest today. What an insight. I'm just wondering, does anyone know where the child is today?
Well, I never did anything that would identify the child.
I know.
Of course, the child is no longer a child. He's in his 70s. He married. There's a record of his having been married around 1970. Had a family. One fact that I've been given was that the first child was named Michael. And another source says that there were three children. He had a career, and he's in retirement from that career.
And doesn't want to talk to anybody.
Absolutely
about it.
Absolutely not.
He could make a fortune if
he's decided
in today's
that
world.
He doesn't want to. According to Father Halloran, the kid had no knowledge, no memory of anything that had happened during the whole ordeal, and woke up and said, "He's gone." in the end of the thing. And so that means there was something in his head at that time that he did remember, but then it all fades away. That's the story that I was given.
Another of the stories that I have heard, there was someone talked about this on the radio a couple of weeks ago and said, I live next door to the mm-hmm. house where this kid lived, and that house was closed up, and that the people who live there, live nearby, hear strange goings on there all the time. That is not the version in your book.
Yeah.
The house ultimately burned down.
Right. There's a real mystery. There's a kind of geographical mystery inside it. When I got the diary, the boy is identified and his address is given on the first page of that. I decided instantly that I would never use that address and I would never use the name of the boy. While I was doing research in that area, there was a house that was notoriously known as the Exorcist House. People really believed that that's where the house was. And I make reference to it in the book because that house was pretty well known in that neighborhood as the Exorcist book. There's no record of that family having lived in that house. It became the center of all kinds of weird stories. And finally, the volunteer fire department gets permission. It's an abandoned house. It's full of broken, and derelicts will show up. They get permission to burn it to the ground. And that's what they did.
We have to take another break. Okay. This hour is really speeding by. We're talking with Tom Allen, author of Possessed, The True Story of an Exorcism. Of course, you've learned by now that that exorcism took place here in St. Louis and was the basis of the book and the film The Exorcist. Back to take more of your calls, emails, and tweets in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back to our conversation with Tom Allen, the author of Possessed, The True Story of an Exorcism. We have a number of folks, Tom, who want to get into the conversation, but I have an email here from Susan. Where can we find records of other exorcisms in St. Louis? Details of my grandmother's exorcism has been retold by family members for decades. Could it have been an Augustinian brother who performed the ritual?
Wow. I have no idea who is the exorcist in the St. Louis area. The priest who has that function is never really publicly identified by any diocese. And on a high diocesan level, nobody ever discusses exorcism. If she's going to find out anything, she'll have to find it out from her grandmother.
Why don't they discuss it? Why all this secrecy?
I've never found anything definitive on that. My hunch is that the church is constantly trying to move forward into the 21st century and looks upon exorcism as a sort of a something that used to be more popular than it is. I mean, there's, you go back into the 16th century, 17th century, 18th century. There's plenty of exorcisms, and it's publicly known. A lot of things are written about it. And then writing about it just dies off. When I was working on the book, I only found one other record of an exorcism. It was in Ohio, or Illinois, rather. And there was very scant details on it. It didn't look that authentic.
Well, the question of possession has been around for a long time.
Absolutely.
I think the Salem witch trials, for instance,
yep.
Which was largely a Protestant community,
yeah.
they dealt with it a little bit differently.
Well, my grandmother used to say, when somebody would do something dopey or silly, she would say, well, what possessed him to do
exactly.
that? And that idea, what possessed him, is an old idea.
Sure.
And that's been around for a long time, that there's always some guy inside you making you do the bad things. The devil made me do it.
You've spent some time at St. Louis University, obviously, mm-hmm. During your time here in St. Louis. We've had a number of questions coming in with regard to a building that is haunted over there. What can you tell us about that, if anything?
There's nothing there that has connection with the exorcism except the church. The church was standing at that time, and there was a report that a Jesuit gave me that right after the exorcism successfully ended, there were people in the church who looked up and saw an image of St. Michael the Archangel bathed in a great light. So that's an association. The kid was going to be baptized a Catholic in that church, and Father Bowdern, who was the exorcist, thought that he might desecrate the church if they did it there. So the actual baptism of the child was done in the rectory, and the rectory is no longer there.
We have an email, I guess it is, from John in Crestwood saying, was the boy taken to a Jesuit retreat?
Yes, he was, just for the day. And it's in the book. They have larger-than-life statues of the Stations of the Cross out there. And he was taken around the Stations of the Cross. And he bolts out and heads for the cliff. And the Jesuit who was with him, who was then a scholastic, Halloran, told me he tackled the kid, held him down. So he turned wild out there. And they put him in the car and took him back to the Alexian Brothers Hospital.
Another call. Bruce will join us from St. Louis. Bruce, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Thank you, Don, for the opportunity. I just had a question for Mr. Allen, if he had any additional information. My family, my last family name is Marin. And according to the book and the movie that William Peter Blatty wrote, there was a Father Marin in the room. He was the older priest of the two. And actually, in reality, there was a Father Marin. He was my great uncle. Hmm. He was under Cardinal Glennon at the time. Hmm. So I just wondered if that name ever surfaced during your research.
No, it didn't. I wonder if it was just a slip on Blatty's part that he put a real name in when he meant to have. Everything else is an assumed name in the book and in the movie. Uh-huh. I have no idea where that could have come from. I mean, can you track your own family down for that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, he was the pastor of the old cathedral around 1940 and then was the assistant to Cardinal Glennon up until Cardinal Glennon's death. So, I'm sure he had some involvement.
Yeah, there was involvement by a lot of Catholic clergy in the area. And one of the problems, which I mentioned in the book, is that Archbishop Ritter, later become Cardinal Ritter, was in the process of integrating the Catholic schools in St. Louis. He was getting death threats. He issued an edict promising excommunication for anyone who tried to prevent the integration of the schools. And that was really what he was concerned with. He was not that concerned with the exorcism. However, he had authorized it, which set the whole thing in motion.
That brings me to another point that is very obvious from your book, of how political all of this could be within the church itself.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you didn't dare make a move without making sure that the people in the hierarchy were okay with it.
When you start trying to research exorcisms, all of the material, the real material for a researcher is locked up in the archives of the church. And you just can't get at them. I've tried to get at the archives of the Archdiocese of St. Louis and also the Archdiocese of Washington, knowing or having been told that there is material about the exorcism in both of those archives, but they're inaccessible.
No way to get at it.
Yeah.
Let's take another call. We'll bring in Kevin calling from St. Louis. Kevin, thank you for waiting. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I have a quick question. I was wondering if you either suspect or think that there was some sort of a force possessing this child. Can you give me any idea or give us any kind of an idea what you would think the nature of this entity would be? Because we hear so often that the child was possessed by the devil. I find that highly unlikely. If the devil exists, he's probably not going to take time to wreak havoc on an individual person. He's probably a pretty busy guy. So have you ever thought about maybe what the nature of this being or entity could have been? And thank you.
Well, if you want to, at the end of the spectrum where there is faith, that in there, it's not the devil, it's a demon. It's one of the devil's hench persons, if you want to say, Colin said in a henchman, that the devil isn't going to bother, but he's going to send some demons. That's at the faith end of the spectrum. When you run down the spectrum to the possible psychiatric aspect of it. You can spend 2 minutes with any psychiatrist and they'll tell you that people believe there are people inside them. making him do the bad things. And that raises the whole issue of evil and good. I mean, we strive for good and we find ourselves doing evil. So when you get at that end of the spectrum, there aren't any demons, except the kind that psychiatrists find, just living inside us. And that's the part of the spectrum that I find myself in.
Hasn't there been a suggestion, I think even in your book, that Robbie may have been possessed, I'm doing air quotes here, by more than one at a time?
Yeah. And that, again, is back to all of the theology about exorcism involves multiple demons. When Christ starts talking to the demon in one of the biblical accounts of Christ's exorcism, the demon says, "We are legion." And when he's casting out, he's casting out demons, and they're going into that herd of pigs and goes over the cliff. It's not the devil that's there, it's the demons. So that's the theology of it.
One of the other things that is interesting in your book and this communication with whatever they were communicating with was sending kind of coded messages that they were trying to unscramble.
Yeah, that just is mystery within the mystery within a mystery, because he indicates he wants to actually write something. And for some reason, they get sheets of cloth, not pieces of paper. Mm-hmm. I've never figured that one out. And he starts writing, and the writing doesn't seem to make any sense. But there's like a struggle for communication that seems to be going on inside the boy.
Yeah. There also is the Roman numeral 10 that features into this. Yeah. They try to think that meant 10 days.
10
that
days, right.
This would be, that they would leave in 10 days.
Yeah. And guess what? The demon lied. They were figuring that he was going to leave on a certain day. And that was on the basis of what's being said by a demon. Mm-hmm. Don't trust a demon. And then they developed the theory that it'll happen at Easter, and it doesn't happen at Easter. But finally, it just happens, and that's the end of it.
I want to get back to the Easter connection in a moment, but let's bring in Lily, calling from St. Louis. Lily, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
I was just wanted to mention that a friend of mine who was in one of the bands I was in had mentioned to me at a rehearsal, and the people who knew him most of his life, that his father was like the orderly, because he was such a huge man who would help secure the child. And he never really spoke of anything to the family about it because of being, signed to secrecy and everything. But it was just kind of interesting that he would mention that after all those years. And it's there are some real strange things in the world.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you on that. What I've found is that there are also veterans of combat who don't like to talk about combat. And I think it's something like that, that if you've got a pretty horrible memory in you somewhere, people might tell you, "We'll talk it out." But if you don't feel like doing it, it stays inside you and you don't talk about it.
Also, I was told he was signed to secrecy, so he really wasn't supposed to speak much of it.
Well, that permeates this whole story,
is the
need for secrecy. But there were times when this child was violent and very, very active, where he did have to be forcibly restrained, and some big guys were brought in, particularly the Alexians, brought in to do just that. We have an email here from Lucy asking, "What, if anything, do you know about Aunt Tilly? Huh. My dad is a St. Louis exorcism hobbyist, and one of his favorite characters in this tale is the boy's purported favorite aunt who lived in St. Louis named Aunt Tilly." It was actually Harriet, wasn't it?
Well, I gave her the word. I gave her the name Harriet.
Oh, okay.
But it may be. I don't do anything that identifies a child. But when I was working on the book, I went to the Bureau of Vital Records and found out that she had died on a certain day, the real person. She had died at the very beginning of all this. And for some reason, the family linked her death at this time to the onset of what let's call it the possession, okay? And at the onset, she was always dealing with a Ouija board. She used and when she dies, the boy resumes working with the Ouija board. And I think they started to see that that was some kind of gateway to what was going to happen.
Well, we've heard that story before, too. If you want to believe in such things, we've certainly heard it before. Let's try to get Glenn into the conversation. But very quickly, Glenn, we're running out of time.
Yeah, hi. Is there a possibility that these reports are, has anyone suggested, that they're a cover-up for abuse from priests? We know it's real common all over this country, all over the world. And has anybody ever suggested that some of these priests who've been convicted are themselves possessed?
Well, I find it highly unlikely. Every single exorcist prayer, every night from about the middle of March to the end to the middle of April, well, actually, it started in January. There's always witnesses. There's never a situation where there's one person with the boy. I think it's far fetched to think there was any abuse involving the priest, certainly.
Thank you so much for the call. As time winds down here, you mentioned the fact that this all was resolved around Easter time, but not on Easter.
Not on Easter.
This almost sounds too good to be true to have it happen at this particular season.
Yeah. Well, they were going by an idea that Father Bowdern had, and that is in the early church, very early, first century, second century, if you were converting to Catholicism, the day you did it was Easter Saturday, and you would say, I renounce Satan on that day, and then on Sunday, Easter itself, you would become converted to Christianity. And so he had an idea that the demon would follow that timeline. And it became so he was finding evidence that was going to happen, and it didn't. Again, you can't trust the demon.
No, absolutely.
So eventually what happens is the demon says there's one word that the kid is never going to say. And then all of a sudden, one morning, the kid bursts out and said he's gone. And although later they say he doesn't remember anything, he tells about a dream he had. He said it was more than a dream. It was like a dream. And he has somebody who looks a lot like St. Michael fighting demons, plural, with a flaming sword, and that person turns to Robbie in the dream and says, Dominus. And that's the word that he wasn't supposed to be able to say.
And that's the way it ended.
Yeah.
In 15 seconds, do you have an explanation for that?
No.
Okay, well, we'll wait until you figure it out and for the next book. Tom Allen, thanks so much for being with us. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. The book, if you want more detail about this famous St. Louis exorcism, is Possessed, The True Story of an Exorcism by our guest, Tom Allen. It's been a great pleasure meeting you, sir. Thank you. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about compassion fatigue and ways to prevent the condition among nurses in connection with a successful program at Barnes Jewish Hospital. And we'll talk with Rob Havers of the National Churchill Museum in Fulton, Missouri, about today's ceremony at the U.S. Capitol honoring the British leader Winston Churchill. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.